You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
I want to remind you a little bit of what we're doing during this Advent season as we work our way through different chunks of Matthew around the coming of Jesus. That's going to be the exception. That will be Christmas Eve, when we're in the book of Revelation, which is the best place to be on Christmas Eve. But leading up to that on Christmas Eve, at least for this week and the following week, we are working our way through different stories in the book of Matthew. And the reason we're doing that is Matthew is a gospel writer who's intent on doing two things. First, he wants to just tell us the story. He wants to give us the history of the coming of Jesus into the world. What happened, who showed up, what was going on at the time. He's trying to kind of frame historically for us what it means that Jesus has come into the world. But he's also trying to do something else. And he's doing it by dropping these hints kind of in a couple of different places for us throughout this story, where he goes back to and refers back to Old Testament promises, Old Testament prophecies, even this week, Old Testament stories. And the goal is to tell us not just what happened, but why it happened. But what is not just what has happened in terms of the coming of this one who is called the Messiah or the Christ, but also what did it actually mean? But where is it coming from? Matthew sees the story of the coming of Jesus, not just as kind of this interesting historical kind of moment, but he actually sees it as this climactic moment in the course of the history of the entire world. And so what he wants to do, interwoven throughout his telling of this story, is these references back to the Old Testament, where he's telling us again and again and again, with small hints here and there, saying, this coming of this child, it's more momentous than you could possibly imagine. The coming of this child is the culmination of all the promises of God. Every hope that you've longed for a first century Jew, the songs that you have sung, the promises that you've taken hold of, all of them are kind of reaching their climactic moment in the coming of Jesus. And so as we work our way through Advent, we want to listen to Matthew's voice and kind of clue ourselves into what exactly he's telling us about the coming of Jesus and the implications of that for our lives. Now this week, we get to a place that, as I was reflecting on what God is actually trying to tell us through Matthew in this story today, this horrific story, I began to think about our previous home. And our previous home, we had a garden. Now, one of the interesting things that you will, you get to know my wife and I at all, one of the things that you will find is that my wife is the skilled one and I am the unskilled one. And so that was reflected over and over again in our house. As if you walked into our living room, you would see a built-in couch, built into one of those like round window things that my wife built. If you go into our bedroom, you will see a bed that my wife built. And yet, if you went into a room where I had finished the trim or redone the trim in our previous house, you would see that I had done the trim because it was just never quite right, unless you like gaps in your trim. And so that's kind of the back and forth that you would see between my wife and I. She has the skilled labor and I'm the unskilled labor. And so she was committed to taking a plot of land in our old home and seeing it converted into a garden. Now, when we moved into the home, the area that she dedicated to say, hey, this is going to be our garden, was a place that was, it resembled a jungle where things would kill you. It was just overgrown. There were weeds. There were various sorts of thorny trees. It was almost like a defensive barrier, if you're thinking in terms of needing a defense around your house. It was like a defensive barrier. Like, nobody's going to be able to get through that to get to the window, to get in, to break in and do things that they do when they break in, because they'll just get stuck and maybe be lost and die. There might be animals there to kill you. There's all kinds of things happening in this little area of our house. One of the things that my wife began to do one spring is she just began to labor slow and hard to first kind of rip up all of this tangled mass of deadly growth, and then to begin to break up the earth and to bring in dirt that actually could grow things there. And what began to evolve over the course of a few years was actually a really great garden, a garden where we had tomatoes. The kids would actually race out and take the tomatoes off before they got too big And we never got to enjoy them in salads because our kids would eat them beforehand. But peppers and pumpkins and tomatoes and the labor, the transformation that took place that honestly was the work of my wife. I was there to like carry things that she skillfully removed. What was the transformation of a place that was just overgrown and brambles and broken to a place that was actually bearing incredible amounts of fruit. And that story kind of sets before us one of the most painful realities that we find in Scripture, and it's held up for us in the story that Matthew gives us. That there's a kind of breaking, a kind of uprooting that we seem to find again and again in Scripture. And if we're honest and begin to reflect on our lives, we begin to see again and again in our own lives where something is being torn up, something is being torn out, something is being broken up. And it's painful. And most of the time we live in those spaces and we don't know what to do with all of the pain. We don't know what to do with the stuff that's getting dragged out of us. We don't know what to do with what feels like extended seasons of despair and darkness. And yet Matthew steps into a situation that is marked by extreme darkness, and he points back to a promise made by God by the prophet Jeremiah. And so I want to take the next few minutes and look at this a little more closely and try to get at something that Matthew's trying to tell us about the coming of Jesus. First, just consider the story again for a moment. It's become so familiar to us, whether it's through Christmas pageants or it's through cartoon specials or it's through just showing up at church on Christmas Eve, if you've done that in your life. And we hear this story again and again and again. But I want you to consider again the darkness that Matthew pulls out for us and wants us to look at. I want us to look at it and maybe feel a bit of it this morning. But first, you have a family that has traveled a great distance. They've gone to a small town, and in that small town, it just so happens that this new family, this brand new couple that's just gotten married, they give birth to their firstborn child. Probably during this season, Mary and Joseph and the soon-to-be-born Jesus have experienced some measure of social ostracization in the town that they've come from. We actually know from later in other Gospels, when Jesus goes back to his hometown, there's both good things remembered about him and there are jokes made about his scandalous appearance, that Mary and Joseph were not married when Mary appeared pregnant. And so they travel from their hometown, where they're probably experiencing some measure of social ostracization. There's too many syllables in that word to say it correctly, so I'm just going to leave it there. The O word. And they go to this town, this small town. They journey to that town. They're waiting an inn. They're having to appear for a government census. Imagine if you had to travel to your hometown every time the government tried to do a census, and you had to ride a donkey to get there, and you decided once you got there, you're going to give birth to your firstborn son. And then while you're there, some amazing things happen, right? Some shepherds show up. Luke tells us to worship your son. A little while later, we three kings, three magicians from the Far East show up to worship your son. And then you're warned in a dream. Now, women, just imagine if you woke up one morning and your husband turns to you and says, "Hey, I had a dream last night. We have to go to Egypt. I don't have a job. I don't really know how we're going to live there, but we have to go to Egypt. We can't go back home. We're going to go to Egypt." And so this family uproots themselves and makes a very long journey to go to Egypt to hide out because they've been warned that someone's going to try to kill them. Now, it's difficult to move in our day, right? To kind of uproot yourself from family, to uproot yourself from friends, to pack all your stuff in a U-Haul, to go to a new town, to start a new job, to go to school, whatever it is that kind of drags you off to a new place. But imagine for a second, in a time and a place where people didn't just move, right? Like, we live in Denver, Colorado. Most people who are here aren't from here. So most of the people in this room, just statistically, we all moved. But you're living in a time and place where people didn't move. You grew up in the same town. You did what your father did. You had the same friends. You lived in the same place that you grew up, and you spent your entire life there. Now imagine yourself as a brand new family, just married, just had their new child, and they've got to hop back on a donkey, and they've got to ride to another country, and they got to somehow build a life there because somebody's going to try to kill them. This isn't sentimental and warm and cute. It's tragic. It's terrifying. It's become an overly familiar story for us. But the story of the coming of Jesus is not a bright, kind of happy, warm, Christmassy story. The shepherds are nice. Three magicians, that's nice too. But fleeing for your life to another country? And then Herod, this incredibly evil king, the wise man that we talked about last week, rather than going back to Herod and doing what he'd asked, which is report where exactly he's to find this promised Messiah, this promised king, they go back another way. They don't want to go back and see Herod. They have been warned as well. Hey, Herod's up to no good. He wants to do something that's horrible here. Herod realizes he's been tricked, and he flies into a fury. And in this fury, he sends soldiers to Bethlehem. He knew that was where it was because the wise men said that's where they were going. And he kills every single male child in this village under the age of 2. All of them. Historians would say that based on the relative size of Bethlehem and the expected kind of population around Bethlehem, that would have been probably 20 to 30 children massacred, slaughtered. Merry Christmas. I mean, this is the story that we tell every year. It's not like a Frosty the Snowman kind of story. It's dark. You see, embedded at the very heart of the story of the coming of Jesus, the story of Christmas, is a shouting reminder that we live in a place that is desperately broken and marked with pain. But one of the difficulties with Christmas every year is if you happen to be in a season of life where you don't feel Christmassy, the lights and the snowmen that dance to music and the reindeer and the really just awful, cheesy Christmas movies that are really just so sappy and filled with happiness, they can be just oppressive, right? But how many experiences with Christmas you've had where it's just been a season of darkness for you, a season of sadness for you, and yet, and what is normally hard, now all of a sudden in Christmas, you're being reminded literally every store you walk into, every time you flip on the radio, every time you just drive down the street and see the person that got just a little bit overly excited about putting lights on their house. You are now not just having a hard season, but you're shamed every time you go out of your door that you're not happy enough, that things are really bright and cheerful. But at the heart of the story of Christmas is horrific evil, horrific pain, loss. And we, I want to up the ante a little bit. This darkness, it really is not just a description of what's going on in Bethlehem at the time or what happens to be going on in the socio-political world around Jerusalem at the time. It is something that is pervasive in the world that we live in. I mean, there's never, I don't remember a season, maybe this is the first season I've ever paid attention, where the reality of what's happening in the world, what's happening around the world of politics, what's happening in the world just in terms of the relationship between men and women in the world, everything that's happening, there's just a pervasive darkness, and for maybe it's just I've turned 40 and I'm getting old, but realizing like I can't fix any of it. Like we can't vote the right person in office and suddenly the darkness of the world gets fixed. We can't just kind of reform the educational model and kind of get all of our get everything lined up or pour more money in or do whatever the thing is, and then all of a sudden the world gets fixed. We can't just kind of reason with people and the world get fixed. But it's not just the world and society out there. When it comes down to it, like if I just look at my own life, there's pain, there's anxiety, there's fear, there's things in me that when I'm really honest and look inside, I can't fix it and it hurts. There's sin, there's being sinned against, there's pain. And at the very heart of the Christmas story is an acknowledgement that this world is marked deeply by darkness, by pain, that we can't fix, but we can't just make it better. And as Matthew tells us this story, he reaches all the way back to the book of Jeremiah, and he quotes this quote, saying, "A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more." I want us to take a few minutes and look at Jeremiah chapter 31. You see, this verse here is a clue. Matthew is telling us, hey, go back there. Look at this. Here's what God is up to. Here's what God is doing. And if you go back to Jeremiah chapter 31, I'd love for you to turn back there if you have your Bibles or your phones or your scrolls. If you turn back to Jeremiah chapter 31, I want to run through a list that's just in these verses. Really starting in verse 1, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but really running from verse 1 through verse 20, there's a theme that begins to percolate in Jeremiah 31 that I think Matthew is pointing back to as he confronts us with the reality of the darkness that attended the coming of Jesus. So I made a list of 9. In verse 1, it says, "The people who survived the sword found grace in the wilderness." Verse 3, when Israel sought for rest, in other words, they're tired, they're broken, they're exhausted. The imagery here is not just they're sleepy. The image here is they don't know how to go on anymore, and they're desperate to find rest, to find peace. And the Lord appeared to him from far away. In verse 9, God promises Israel, God promises people, "With weeping they shall come, and with pleas for mercy I will lead them back." Verse 10, "Hear the word of the Lord, O nations, and declare it in the coastlands far away. Say, he who scattered Israel will gather him and will keep him as a shepherd keeps his flock." Verse 11, "For the Lord has ransomed." That's a word that is attached to the concept of slavery. That here's this idea that Jacob is in slavery and God has purchased them back. So they were in this situation of darkness and enslavement, and God purchases them. Verse 11 again, another slavery word, "and has redeemed him from hands too strong from him." He's gone and rescued him from an oppressor that he could not break free from. Verse 12, "and they shall languish no more." And verse 13, "and I will turn their mourning into joy. I will comfort them and give them gladness for sorrow." And then again in verse 16, "keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is a reward for your work." And the word there for work is the labor, the suffering, this idea that you've been in suffering, you've been in labor, and something good is coming, declares the Lord, and they shall come back from the land of the enemy. It seems throughout Jeremiah 31, Jeremiah is holding up to this picture, and it's a hard picture. You see, throughout Jeremiah 31, there is these promises, beautiful promises of dancing. My favorite phrase in the whole chapter is merrymaking, because who doesn't want to do merrymaking? So there's merrymaking, and there's dancing, and there's singing, and there's wine, and there's food, and there's celebration, and there's joy, and it's all coming out of intense amounts of pain. This is what God does. He brings about, permits, ordains pain in our lives that eventually gives birth to joy. See, the hardest thing about Jeremiah 31 is not simply that there's suffering there, but rather the text is very, very clear. And if you go back in Jeremiah, it's even clearer that this suffering is not mere circumstance. That this pain that these people are enduring, this pain that you're enduring, it's not just circumstance. It's strategy. It is God Himself's plan for you, His purpose. And we get all mixed up over what this person sinned against me. Are you saying God sinned against me? No. Like that's the two realities that the Bible holds up over and over again. Whatever pain you're enduring, God is not responsible for it. He's not the one who is He doesn't sin against you, but He is absolutely sovereignly ordaining all of it for you. There are no accidents. There are no mere circumstances. But the thing that Jeremiah holds up, look specifically in verse 9. He says, "With weeping they shall come, and with pleas for mercy I will lead them back." This is what God does. He ordains, He purposes suffering and brokenness and pain in our lives. And here's the aim: that He might lead you back home. Now, we struggle with this. We don't know what to do with it, right? But we look at pain in our lives, and it leads us to despair. It leads us to anger. There have been seasons in my life where just inexplicable anger kind of rises up in me. Because my life's not what I want it to be. There's more pain there. There's more suffering there. There's things there that I don't want to be there. And yet they're there. We struggle with what to do with all of this pain. And the Bible, this theme of God bringing about, ordaining suffering that results in a merrymaking, that results in joy, that results in glory. It's not just a theme that appears once. It's a theme that appears over and over and over again. You see it with King David. He is anointed. He's raised up. He's becomes like the kind of hero of the people of Israel. And then next thing you know, he's on his run. The ordained king is trying to kill him and hunt him down. You see this with the story of Israel themselves. Like they sin, and yet God ordains, promises them, even as they're coming out of Egypt, you're going to rebel against me, and I'm going to lead you into intense amounts of pain and suffering, and yet I'm going to bring you back. It's going to bring about your salvation. It's going to bring about your redemption. You see it in the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, as his brothers, I don't know what your relationship with your brothers are, but his brothers sell him into slavery. And there was a debate, do we kill him or do we sell him into slavery? So whatever your brothers are like, they're better than that. And yet when he meets his brothers at the very end of that story, what does he say to them? What you intended for evil, God intended for good, to bring about salvation. This is not just circumstance. It's a plan. It is a strategy. There is a purpose that in the end it will drive us back to a God. Now, what is this supposed to do in us? One of the themes that comes up in the Psalms again and again and again, and I think it, until you come to terms with this reality, you'll never come to terms with the Psalms. This theme, it actually appears 21 times in the Psalms, where the psalmist cries out, "How long, O Lord?" and then describes whatever circumstances they're in, whatever pain they're experiencing, whatever difficulty they're going through, and says, how long is this going to go on? How long are you going to permit this to happen? How long are you going to turn your face from me? How long am I going to anguish in this pain, in this sin, in this brokenness, in this place that I don't know how to move forward to? How long, oh Lord? And it is this groaning that it's at the very foundation of what it means to be the people of God, that we live in the midst of a world ordered by God, ordained by God, sovereignly ruled over by God, that is marked and interwoven with darkness and pain and suffering, and we don't know what to do with it. And the cry of those who belong to a God like this is, how long, O Lord? And this is what Advent is, where we as a people learn to groan again. But we learn to face the dark realities of the world that we live in. We learn to face the dark realities of our pain that we sometimes anesthetize with Netflix binging, or whatever food it is, whatever we can get in front of us to help us forget how much it hurts. And yet Advent and the story of the coming of Jesus is meant to throw into your face in the most rude way possible. This world and your life is marked by pain and darkness. How long, O Lord, until you come? And this is what God does. The beauty of Jeremiah 31 is in the midst of this kind of suffering, the kind of suffering of a mother who has lost a child. That's the description of what's going on. That's Jeremiah's metaphor for the whole history of the world, and what's happening in your life is the pain and the suffering of a woman in travail because her child is dead, is lost. And God comes, and in the midst of it says, it is in the midst of that loss, it is in the midst of that pain, it is in the midst of feeling and being confronted with that kind of brokenness, that you will cry out to me and I will lead you home. This is what God does. I'll flip back over to Matthew as we kind of draw to a close. There's one other prophecy quoted here in Matthew chapter 2 in the section that we read. It's in verse 15. It says, out of Egypt I called my son. And that's taken from prophet Hosea. And it's a theme that is developed that really grows out, again, of the story of Moses, yet another one who endured suffering and pain and the result of his own sin, and yet through it, God actually brought about something glorious and beautiful. One of the pictures that Matthew is trying to paint for us is the coming of Jesus is the coming of a new Moses. The coming of one who would lead his people out of slavery, lead his people out of bondage, lead his people out of pain, lead God's people out of this place of slavery to idols and slavery to people who are stronger than them, this place of anguish and pain. And God would send another Moses, one like Moses, who would bring them out of Egypt, who would bring them out of slavery, who'd bring them out of idolatry, and bring them into deep, ongoing communion with their Father, with their Lord. This is one of the themes that Matthew develops throughout the whole course of his gospel, is to say the coming of Jesus is the coming of Moses, a new Moses. And so in the story of Matthew, these hints, even in the way that he tells the story, is there to remind us again and again and again of this Moses. Moses is born as a baby. Everybody's born as a baby. No, you can write that one down. So he's born into the world, and as he comes into the world, Pharaoh, kind of the lord of all the earth at that point, what is happening at the time? He's sending people, midwives, to kill all the male babies. And this is why Matthew includes this fact in here, is to go back and say, hey, remember that story? interesting kind of common folk tales around the time of Jesus. When people told the story of the birth of Moses, often that story was attended with the visit of, this is really crazy, it's in Josephus, the visit of magicians. They visited Pharaoh and warned Pharaoh that some liberator, some redeemer was going to be born. And that was kind of the thing, the impetus for Pharaoh going and having all the male children killed out of Israel. It was an additional kind of warning given to them. I don't know if that's true or not, but it is true in the literature and the culture. So Matthew's playing into that story. All of this stuff is happening, and Matthew is shouting at us again and again and again. The coming of Jesus is the coming of this liberator. The coming of this Jesus is the coming of this Moses, this one who would free God's people from slavery. And here is God's son, the true son of Israel, who dies and suffers in our place and is raised from the dead 3 days later. Here is the hope of all the world, who dies at the hand of a king, whose mother is at the foot of the cross weeping and groaning for the loss of her son. And 3 days later, he will come out of the grave. And there will be celebration, and there will be dancing, and there will be wine, and there will be bread, and there will be merrymaking. But Matthew comes and he tells us the story of the coming of Jesus. And he puts in our face all of the groaning and the pain. Maybe you don't need it thrown in your face this morning because you're in the middle of it. But the word from the Lord this morning is that it is not mere circumstance, it is his plan, his strategy, that he is dragging you through a season of pain that you may not know its purpose, you may not actually see its full end. The promise is that one day, as we look to this Jesus, this one who suffered in our place, this one who was raised from the dead 3 days later, we are promised an inheritance. We are promised joy. We are promised dancing. And we will be led back to this Father as we cry out for mercy. So in your suffering, may you cry out for mercy. As you look at and experience the darkness of this world, may you cry out for mercy. As you wait patiently day after day after day after day, wrestling with your own sin, wrestling with the sin of a husband or a wife, wrestling with the sin of those around you, may you persevere and cry out again and again and again for mercy. Because in Jesus, God has promised, has absolutely promised, in that cry for mercy, God is leading you home. Let's pray.